Hello again, and welcome back to Full Time with Meg Linehan. I am back with you after the holiday. Thank you, as always, for joining me here on the Athletic Podcast Network for the show all about women's soccer. I am your host, Meg Linehan. I'm a staff writer at The Athletic, covering the women's national team and the NWSL. All right, so we do actually have a United States women's national team to discuss, and things keep happening almost to the point where I would like everyone to take a nap for a week, mostly so that way I could also sleep but finish the feature that I need to write this week. But first, obviously, we've got a show for you, and I am joined by Brooks Peck, one of my editors at The Athletic, and we are breaking down 2020, the year of Kristi Mewis, that is in all caps, the year of Kristi Mewis for you. Then Ariana Scavetti is here to help make sense of what is happening right now in France with the conflict between Amandine Henry and Corinne Diacre going public. But before I get to my best attempt at catching you up on all the news that has been happening, first, you may have seen The Athletic's Black Friday Cyber Monday sale for $1 a month, and I have great news for you if you did not take advantage of it and felt like you missed out, because that deal is still running right now at theathletic.com/fulltime through Friday, December 4th. So you actually have until 11:59 p.m. on Friday night, that's Pacific time, to sign up as a new subscriber to The Athletic for a year. For $12, you will get a full season of NWSL coverage, plus the U.S. Women's National Team run through the 2021 Olympics, assuming, of course, that we have an Olympics and I still hop a flight to Tokyo. But either way, I will be guiding you through a full year of women's soccer, and you can get that for $12 total. But you don't just get my NWSL and U.S. coverage. You also get basically the whole damn site to boot, every story, every feature, news, podcast, you name it, plus The Athletic app. And if you listen to the show, you have heard me plenty on why I think it is super important for you to show your support of coverage of women's soccer. And if you sign up as a new subscriber at theathletic.com/fulltime, that's your dollar a month, giving another data point to show that women's soccer coverage has value. So this episode is dropping, as always, Thursday morning. So you've got until Friday, December 4th at 11:59 p.m. Pacific to get in on this deal for one last time in 2020, $1 a month at theathletic.com/fulltime. Okay, so with that out of the way, let's get into at least some of the news that has happened over the past couple of weeks. This is what I get for trying to take a week off, as both the league and the national team have been keeping us all very, very busy. So last Friday, the U.S. Women's National Team took on the Netherlands in a rematch of the 2019 World Cup final, and a year later replicated that exact same scoreline with a 2-0 win. Rose Lavelle and Kristi Mewis, plenty more on her in a few minutes, of course, provided the goals, and you can read my main takeaways from the match at The Athletic. The short version, though, welcome to the age of Vlatko and Donofsky, for real. It's very exciting. All right, also on the U.S. Women's National Team front, we haven't had a legal update on the equal pay case since May, when the judge overseeing this case issued a partial summary judgment that tossed most of the players' arguments when it came to the Equal Pay Act and Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. Only a few small ticket items remain to actually handle in court, including travel and support personnel for the team. But on Tuesday, the players and U.S. Soccer announced that they had agreed to a proposed settlement on the remaining non-compensation items in that lawsuit, and U.S. Soccer will implement revised policies on four working conditions: charter flights, venue selection, professional support, and hotel accommodations. It is actually kind of a win for both sides. The players have now codified more equal treatment and are one step closer to their appeal on the bigger items. And the Federation is also happy that both sides work together for this resolution and hope that it's the first step in bringing the players back to the table to talk through the actual equal pay front. As Cindy Parlow-Cohn, president of U.S. Soccer, told media on Tuesday night, "This is a good day. I hope that everyone sees we are a new U.S. soccer." Again, plenty more on this story at The Athletic from me as well. Okay, another big one. Definitely keep an eye on what's happening in Utah. As reported by myself and Paul Tenorio, there is potential that the team could move if the NWSL doesn't find a new ownership group that is willing to keep the Royals in Salt Lake. There are a lot of moving pieces here, but there is an ownership group in Kansas City working to bring an NWSL team back there after FC Kansas City shuttered in 2017. City's been without NWSL. Angie and Chris Long are at the heart of this ownership group, and there are also, you know, there are three potential paths here. The Royals could stay in Utah if an ownership group is found in time. The move to Kansas City could happen on an extremely tight turnaround, or the league could actually opt to cease operations for Utah Royals FC and sort out a more stable option through an expansion bid. I'm going to sound like a broken record here, but again, there's a full story on this. This is a big, big idea that is not going to be captured in me talking for 30 seconds. But all of the reporting that we have so far on this front is at The Athletic as well. All right, one more thing. The NWSL has announced the date for the upcoming college draft, January 13th, 2021, and it will be live streamed on Twitch at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. It's also been rebranded a bit as simply the 2021 NWSL draft rather than actually referring it to it as the college draft, so expect all of us, including me, to struggle with that one for a bit. Here's the order of the first 10 picks. At number 1 overall, Racing Louisville FC, 2 Washington Spirit, 3 Sky Blue FC, 4 Chicago Red Stars, 5 back to Louisville, 6 back to Chicago, 7 Houston Dash, 8 back to Chicago, 9 Washington Spirit, and 10 North Carolina Courage. So we're going to see a big first round from Chicago, I am sure. Here's the complicating factor, though, with the NCAA season being pushed back, and I'll just read it right from the NWSL release because it's much easier to follow. Due to the NCAA spring season in 2021, the NWSL has requested a waiver from the NCAA that will allow student athletes who register for the NWSL draft to decide by Friday, January 22nd, 2021, if they will report to their NWSL club before or after the spring collegiate season. If the waiver is denied, players will have the option to either participate in the 2021 NWSL draft and forfeit their remaining collegiate eligibility if selected, or withdraw from the draft registration and play the spring collegiate season, but they will be ineligible to participate in the NWSL during the 2021 season. So basically, really, let's stay tuned on this waiver because it could change a lot. All right, so listen, 2020 has been a wild and challenging ride on all fronts, but if there is one bright shining moment in the women's soccer world for this year, it is Kristi Mewis. Brooks Peck is here to break down her year, the celebrations, and the joy. Before we even really get started, like, let's first start with, you watched the game on Friday. I feel like a lot of people were watching the game on Friday because, A, we haven't gotten a women's national team game in. Everyone has heard the number, 261
Yeah, we needed our fix. I mean, it had been a very, very long time.
So I think everyone, I mean, I personally was being extremely loud on Twitter. Give me my muscles in the midfield. It's all I want.
Meg, I beg you, please write a book with that title. Please.
It's just like, this is the children's book for yes, kids from Massachusetts.
Exactly. Yeah. We'll find an illustrator. It'll be amazing.
The Mewis sisters, you can have that one. Just involve me. Like, I have to be your ghostwriter, please. That's like your joint autobiography.
Ghostwriter. Like, I mean, just the title alone would sell a million copies. That's all you need.
It was one of my finer moments of just like, yes, this is how they just should be referred perfect. To. Like, I know, you know, there's also a lot of discussion about what we call both of them at the same time, whether that's there's just so many new fun avenues.
Yeah,
here.
I think Adam Snavely on Twitter was really into the Mewtwo tag, and I'm on board with that one as well. Yeah, I like that a lot.
All right. So now we know where you stand. I personally, just having covered them both for a while, have always defaulted to Mewi with the double I because I think it's funny. Like, both are good and funny in their own way, but the Mewi with the two I's just deeply amuses
me. We can do both.
We can
switch it up. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So let's do at least, like, we'll pretend like we're going to talk about this game, but was there anything, you know, we were all kind of like just in the Athletic Slack, marveling over Rose Lavelle, which feels very standard for 2020/2019.
Yeah, I mean, it was a great pickup from where we left off, I feel like, with the U.S. national team, because just Rose Lavelle scoring bangers. I mean, it's just the natural order of things. So it was great.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like you are in a fun position of, like, yes, you have to edit my work, but you also get to watch the team from, like, a much more, like, detached point of view, and just you get to kind of enjoy it.
Yeah, I feel like I'm like one step removed, so I can just watch the game while you're frantically doing all the 9 million things you're doing before, during, and after matches. But I can sit there and actually watch the match and enjoy it. And with this one, that's what I did, because it was a very enjoyable performance.
Yeah. I mean, before this game, I was talking with John Halloran on this podcast, being like, we shouldn't have expectations for this game. And then everyone is watching this game and we're like, oh, right. This is what this team is about. Right. Cool. Yeah. All right. I mean, should have just expected this.
Exactly. It was a great introduction for Vlatko's era. And I think it was just a great, fun performance. Yeah, it was great.
All right. So let's talk about Kristi Mewis before we start with the Netherlands game, because we have to build to it, right? This has been...
Yeah, this is a whole progression.
Right. We have to talk about the year of Kristi Mewis.
Yes.
So I want to go back to Challenge Cup, because you have this fantastic story on The Athletic that we have gotten like so much mileage out of. Every time Kristi Mewis does something, we're like, let's talk about Kristi
Mewis. I have tweeted that story out more than anything else I've ever written in my whole career.
So let's go back. What's so fun about Kristi Mewis too from the Challenge Cup win is that she only plays 29 minutes of that game. Like, she gets hurt.
Yeah.
And yet she walks away like the complete star of the day.
You would never know she was hurt. From her post-game performance, you would never know she was hurt.
All right. So how about you give us some of the rundown so that we can relive the joy of Kristi Mewis's summer?
I mean, I think before you even get into Challenge Cup, you have to go through just what she's been through to get to this year. I mean, the fact that her career started off so well, so promising on the national team, 2014, joined on the national team by her sister, you know, her NWSL career is off to a good start. Everything seems to be going Kristi Mewis's way. And then just kind of suddenly, not so suddenly, it fizzles and fades and before you know it,
injuries in there,
a lot of moves. She was on loan in Japan and Germany, and she was with Chicago for a week or something.
For a week.
So just trades and like everything you can experience as a professional soccer player, she went through in this 6 year span between 2014 and now. So just a lot. Just she went through a lot. And I think you need to have that foundation to appreciate just how great this year was for her. Because, you know, it started with in December with the national team camp, getting kind of welcomed back into that fold and being back with Vlatko, who drafted her. So just kind of getting back in the swing of things after this long kind of awful stretch, including the ACL tear. And that just set the stage for Challenge Cup. And, you know, she had this great Challenge Cup, gets hurt in the final, and you think, ah, like she's finally having her moment and she just still can't quite fully enjoy it.
Yeah. And I mean, she comes off the field in tears too.
Like, yeah.
It was like, everyone is watching this just like, oh my God, like not anyone but Kristi.
Yeah.
Like, take my hand straight.
Please. But So you have that image of her going off in tears and you think, oh, she finally gets this success and she still can't fully enjoy it. But how wrong we were. Because not only did she enjoy it, but she enjoyed it more than anyone else on the planet. I mean, just it was so great that Budweiser was the sponsor here, because That just gave her, I feel like, this great tool to use in her celebrations.
I mean, I feel like the image of the NWSL in 2020 is that photo of her with legitimately
an armful of Budweiser.
13, we counted online, 13 of the tall boy aluminum bottles of Bud.
Yeah.
Just like, these are mine.
Yeah.
See you later.
And you know, so the whole Budweiser reveling celebration was really kind of started, I feel like, 2019 World Cup, because the national team just did a great job of it too. So we have to give them some props there.
Right.
But Kristi took it to a new level at the post-Challenge Cup. Just the dances were incredible. The swinging the medal around her neck was incredible. It was just a flawless celebration, and it was 100% the celebration of someone who had never celebrated before. So she was just going all out, and you could just feel that, like, oh my God, I grinded through 6 really hard years, and this is my moment, and I am going all out. I mean,
right?
The quote was, "I never win anything. Let me live." And I think anyone who witnessed her celebration felt that fully, especially this year of all years.
Yeah, I also feel like she really did Massachusetts proud in terms of
Meg. I'm telling like, you,
the willingness to party.
You got to write the book. This is a chapter in the book.
There was also an alter ego for her, right?
Yes,
like she had a whole alter ego.
Crystal, I'm not going to remember her description of Crystal, but. Just
it was something very, very
Christy. Go on Christy's Instagram. She introduced the world to Crystal on there and gave a little description.
Right. Oh, right. Crystal, whose qualities included fun, aggressiveness, and bad behavior.
Yes. I mean, what more do you want in a Crystal?
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
All right. So now we have set the scene through the summer. I mean, you know, she also like came on this podcast actually with some of her Houston Dash teammates. I just remember being like, I think she also posted like a photo of her calling Sam the morning after, and she's got like a jade roller and like a thing of Pedialyte.
Yeah,
probably.
I mean, that was the most impressive part of this whole thing. So she went as hard as you can celebrate, and the next morning, totally fine, like totally unbothered, just great, doing great.
As a mid 30-year-old, I envy the bounce back.
That was the most impressive part of the whole thing to me.
Yeah. All right. So we've got the setup. And then, I mean, it really begins with Flacco naming his roster for an October camp, which was obviously like super NWSL heavy because at that point, still in the US and players from Europe can't come over. But it gives Mewis the shot of like really getting her foot back in the door.
Yeah. And I mean,
with the national team.
Also, we can't forget that she probably had an even better fall series than the Challenge Cup. So she really kept it going throughout the year. It wasn't just like a flash in the pan, great tournament. It was a full year of good work.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was really interesting just to see the differences between Challenge Cup, which did have that tournament format, had that grind, whereas fall series you get kind of like what at least felt like more of a regular season experience in terms of like the games actually being spread out for
the pace of it,
amount of time. But yeah, I mean, like, again, like scoring goals, also her assists were kind of off the charts this year as well. Like, it's not just the fact that she can score goals. Yeah. It is the fact that she is kind of now the creative engine of the Houston Dash, which is really exciting because also as someone who covered her on the national team in the 2013-2014 era, I mean, there was a joke, my friend Mark, who is on Twitter, used to have like a acronym hashtag for Christy Mewis is not a left back, because that's where she was getting the attempted conversion, and it was not going super well just in terms of, and it's not on her really. Like we have seen a lot of players tried, you know, like to get forced into that outside back conversion, and like the success rate varies by player, but Christy Mewis is fundamentally a creative attacking midfielder. So it is extremely nice to see a team put her at the center of their operations and then figure out what the pieces are that need to be around her.
And I mean, I think a lot of that goes back to Vlatko being the manager now. He knows her, he's followed her career. I think having that friendly face, someone who believes in you and you know who believes in you, goes a long way as well. for sure.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, after the Netherlands game, and I brought up the 2013 thing, he was immediately like, Meg, I was the one that drafted her. Don't forget. And yeah. I was like,
he wants his credit there.
Yeah, he does. And she went number three in the first college draft. So it's not like it was a low pick. It was that was his number one pick that year.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So let's get into the October camp. I mean, obviously we don't have a huge amount of visibility to it, but what Vlatko has said is like, no, she earns her way here. Like she earned it off of that NWSL performance. And then she gets the next step, which is the November call up for the friendly. Mm-hmm. And then thus begins the crusade for Massels.
Yes.
So what did when she takes the field mm-hmm. in the Netherlands in that second half, and we finally get a look of her on the field, what was your initial impression? Is it just, for me, it's just like pure joy. And I'm like, soccer comes second. I just want her on that field.
This was the thing, because after Challenge Cup, it really felt like, okay, she had this amazing moment in a year of not many amazing moments for most people. This was it. And like, that's amazing. That's great. So yep. I didn't really have high expectations for the national team experience, because I thought, okay, if that's it, that's it, that's great. But when she came on, I mean, obviously she was just so excited. Giant
smile. That smile.
Yeah, just even before she got to the touchline, she was just like beaming. So that was incredible. And then she comes on the field and is just ecstatic. She even said after the game she couldn't contain it. You know, it was just too much. So yeah, like you said, like if just entering the match was all she got, again, that's an amazing moment on the field with her sister again. It's great. So you think, okay, she'll have this time, and maybe this is the foundation for years to come, and she can start to build back her national team career. I did not expect the goal. that was just like the cherry on top of the cherry on top. That was incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, I let out a scream. Like, I really wish that I had been just recording myself, because it was the scream that I was like, oh no, are my neighbors going to think a murder is happening here? Like, it wasn't even like a fun, like, happy scream. Yeah. It was just full on, like, there's no control of the sound coming out of my body. And then, like, it was immediately like, oh no, I'm going to start crying. But then to also have the first people there are Alex Morgan and Sam Hughes, and like, you know, that was why I wanted after the game to ask her, like, the fact, I mean, like, and Sam, you could see Sam, like, full on sprinting.
It was just so, it was just so, the levels of perfect to just everything about her professional career this year. It's like, you couldn't have written it better. It's just nuts. But
yeah, it was also like the joy of that too is generally I try to like yell at my friends who wanted like text me during U.S. national team games, because I'm like, no, this is work for me, guys. Like, I know we want to talk stuff. Like, it's cool. Like, I have my work chat, and I have like one specific chat that we will like talk about, you know, like work kind of related stuff. But then my friend Jess and I, who, you know, like we used to go to Revs games in Boston, but like we also, when I quasi retired from women's soccer coverage, would go to Boston Breakers games together. And there is a photo that my friend Jess took of me in the stands at Harvard Stadium holding one of the like flags that we would have. And the joke of that was for Christy, right? Like, we were like, just like a tiny little, we're going to like be nuts Boston Breakers Christy Mewis supporters section. And so like that entire game, she's just texting me for Christy. And it was just like both of us being like, I have so many emotions.
But
like,
even on top of that, just... Meg, so you were there for her first and previously only national team goal. And you took a great
photo. Happened at Gillette Stadium, right? It happened in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
It's like this weird little tap and goal off of like a Sidney LaRue attempt. And the photo that I took, because I was taking photos at the time, is just like her pure reaction of just like, oh, I don't know what to do. Like, it's just pure Christy Mewis of like mid reaction, like, this is happening, I guess. And it was so awesome because it happened in Massachusetts. Her whole family is there. You know, like, it was just such a really cool, fun moment. And that was her first year in the league.
And that was seven years ago. So now she finally scores her second national team goal, breaks a record in the span between
it's
the
like
two.
It's like 2,700 days
yeah.
and change. between goals.
And I think we can't forget in all of this is that it was a really good goal too. Like
it was
the fact that she split those defenders and placed the ball so perfectly in the far corner. Like that was not an easy.
It's a nice goal. Finish.
It really, really
it's
was.
It's like a legitimately really nice goal. And I mean, she even said post game, like I was nervous to take that shot. But it, I mean, in terms of like a pure fit, like that's a great goal.
And especially all things considered, like you've waited for this moment for 7 years and now it's in front of you and it's not an easy thing to execute and you do it perfectly. It's just amazing. That
it's also against a team like the Netherlands. Yes. It's a rematch of the 2019 World Cup. Like we're not talking about, like, I think her other goal came against, it was like the two matches that they had against Korea because the next one is actually when Wambach breaks the scoring record. Mm-hmm. So like even at that game at Gillette, they were trying to feed Abby the entire game of like, go, 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 go. But like ultimately it was a much better choice for her to break that record at Red Bull.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's just like, this is her walking onto a field against a top international opponent. Like it's not her walking into a game against, you know, like some of these smaller opponents that the U.S. tends to play.
Yeah, like, this wasn't a like a 10-0 game where she's just on there for mop-up duty. This was, you know, a top opponent. It was 1-0. It was still very much a game. So yeah, it was just awesome.
So what are your main takeaways from the year of Kristy Mewis? I mean, it just, for me, like it really is such like a nice shining point of light
that
we get in this year. But from someone who is like, obviously I have covered her basically her entire career, right? I also have an investment in her just from a Massachusetts point of view, from, you know, covering her sister. So for
writing
someone who is not necessarily,
book. Yeah,
right. For someone who is not necessarily as emotionally attached, like I also think that Kristy Mewis is such a great story to attract people who might be more casual women's soccer fans.
Yeah.
Like the Dash, I think, were a really good story in terms of what is possible to make reach into a community that has not necessarily paid attention to that team in a super great way in the past, right? Like the Dash have done a lot to turn their relationship with the community around. I think Kristy Mewis is a great like story in the middle of that.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
From your point of view, where are the kind of like the gains there?
Yeah, it really was a great entry point for the casual fan because, I mean, there were just so few examples of people being happy this year. So to see someone just enjoy something that much, anyone can relate to that and appreciate that and want to live vicariously through that. So that just draws you in immediately. But then when you find out more about her backstory and all she went through to get to that point, like, again, this year of all years, people can relate to grinding through things for that eventual payoff, for, you know, looking towards and hoping for that eventual moment of like just being able to enjoy something again and like love that moment. So it was just, you know, when I wrote that first piece about the celebrations and everything, I did kind of have that moment of pause of like, will this seem like it's kind of rubbing this happiness in people's faces, and will people appreciate it or kind of withdraw from it or not like that? But you know, I just think people wanted that, something like that, and to see someone happy just means a lot to people. And that's what the comments were. They were like, it's just so great to see someone having a good year. And
yeah, and I mean, that's I think the weird thing that's been about this year, and even from like my point of view, right? Like I feel like I've had a very successful 2020.
Yeah.
The NWSL has had a successful 2020. Like we've hit new heights in terms of women's soccer this year, which feels so at odds with the rest of this year. Mm-hmm. Kristy Mewis is like the perfect example of it from a player point of view, but fundamentally, like there has been a very good bright spot if you follow women's soccer.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, even the things she said has really kind of drawn into that, as far as like, you know, she's very honest about how for a while she felt that she was okay just being average, and she had to get herself out of that funk and work her way back through all this adversity and maybe kind of take stock of who she was and what she was doing and and her methods and everything, and she just kind of reevaluated and evolved and moved forward and got better. And this is the fruit of that labor. So it's just really cool to see.
All right. Well, I think that's a good spot for us to end our 20-minute session of Christy Mu's appreciation on. I don't think anyone is going to complain about that.
No, can't complain about that. I mean, come on.
All right, Brooks. I mean, obviously, people know that they can find you at The Athletic as I slowly work through my collection of Athletic soccer writers and editors on this podcast. But please tell folks where they can find you on Twitter.
On Twitter, I am at BrooksDT. BrooksDT.
Got that old dirty tackle.
Yeah, just handle. Never changed. Same. I've had the same avatar for 11 years now. It's just is what it is. But yes. Meg, I'm very hopeful that in 2021 we can keep doing this. We can keep having our Christy Mewis fan club sessions on the podcast as this continues, as her good fortunes continue. So.
I know we gotta root for Christy in terms of the roster, yeah. In terms of
this is just the start, Meg. This is the start.
This is just like our quarterly meeting,
exactly.
Our first one.
Yes, yes.
So we will open up applications to the fan club.
Oh yeah, yeah. There's a lot of room on this bandwagon. Let's all jump on, like Christy on top of the table after challenge. No. Start swinging those winners' medals around your neck, people.
All right. Thank you, Brooks, for your time this morning. I super appreciate it. And yeah, all right. So we'll look forward to the next quarterly meeting of the Mass Holes in the midfield.
Let's do it. Get those publishers on the line. I want that book in the works.
All right.
Thanks, Meg.
Thank you to Brooks for hopping on the show. I will keep you all posted on Mass Holes in the midfield, the book. Slowly but surely, also, I am collecting every single writer at the Athletic Soccer Vertical for this podcast. All right, next up, Ariana Scavetti of Lyon Offside is here, and basically I did use this as my excuse to pick her brain about what is happening in France, and not just between the French women's national team captain, maybe, Amandine Henry, and head coach Corinne Diacre, but the federation and their approach to women's football as a whole.
So honestly, like, you tell me where you think we should start in terms of what is happening in France, because there have been a lot of recent events that we have seen on Twitter, especially from you, who I feel like has now become like the translator du jour of U.S. women's national team fandom, trying to figure out what is happening in France. Where does this, like, let's maybe identify, I'll go back to my old life of being in biotech. When something went wrong, we had to identify the root cause. Do we have a root cause in France of what is happening right now?
Yeah, I think, you know, you can go all the way back to the start of Corinne Diacre's tenure as coach of France and see some of the signs of conflicts with players, including star players, you know, right from the very beginning. But where it all really starts to boil over, I think, is in the wake of the World Cup, because the results weren't what the team wanted and expected. And that was, I think, the point where you really saw the team's leaders, Amandine Henry probably first and foremost, but also folks like Eugénie Lissamer, Sarah Bouhadi, Wendy Renard speaking up and saying, you know, it's probably time for the federation to make a change. And since then, it's just kind of been one problem after another for the team.
Right. Okay. So let's get into something that's a little more recent, because it really now feels like, okay, so you just named a few players that were speaking out. Now it really feels like it is Henri.
It is. It
on
is.
Her own. And yes. Where did that shift happen in terms of, was there, okay, so you have four players and then suddenly you have one. So it feels like something must have happened from like a federation point of view or something to be like, no, you're fine. We're sticking with this coach, right? Was there a contract? Was there something definitive there?
Well, this round of the conflict really starts about a month and a half ago. In early October, the president of the federation, Noël Le Graët, comes to Lyon to give the Lyon players a medal to commemorate winning their 7th Champions League title. And the players take that opportunity to go to Le Graët and say, you know, we want to have a conversation about what's happening with Corinne Diacre's management. And so they talk about their vision for the team. They talk about the problems they see, and they think, you know, we're going to get some attention from the Federation now on these issues. Instead, the next day, Diakra calls Henri and tells her that she's not going to be on the list for the next France camp, which was going to be released later that week. It's a 15-second phone call where, you know, Henri says, Diakra said, my list comes out tomorrow. In light of your recent performances, you won't be on it. Henri's shocked. And so was everyone else when the list was announced the next day. You know, Diakra says that she wants Henri to get back to her best level after returning from injury, but there's a lot of skepticism about that claim because also on her list are other midfielders who had been out due to injury. Majeri hadn't played the past two games, Bilbo hadn't played the past two games, and Giro had played, I think, 30 minutes all season, and they all made the list. But right. Henri, who had played three full games, wasn't on it. So yeah. The conclusion essentially was that it was a punishment that Legret had passed word to Diakra that the players had spoken to him, and Diakra had taken out her anger on Henri by leaving her off the list.
Yeah. Okay. So what happens next? Because then Henri goes on television, right? Which feels like, well, she starts speaking out. She says, like, I got this phone call, right?
Right. Exactly. If Diakra thought that keeping Henri off the list was going to scare the players into silence, yeah. She badly miscalculated, because right when she made the decision, several of Henri's teammates spoke up immediately to say, you know, this is incoherent, it doesn't make any sense, this is a crazy decision. But Henri herself didn't say too much at first. But a few weeks ago, she went on Canal Football Club, which is a primetime show dedicated to French soccer. It's like, you know, big and very much in the public focus, and did a one-on-one interview where she told the story of this 15-second phone call, where she talked about how many problems there had been at the World Cup and how it was, you know, total chaos under Diakra, and said that things need to change.
Yeah. I think, okay, so here's my question, and you know, we talked about this a little bit ahead of time. We're like, I personally know I'm looking at this from a filter of watching the U.S. women's national team and how they operate, where they back each other up, right? So the way that I'm watching this, you have a few players talking to, you know, talking about the team itself, right? And then you do have players backing up Henri's omission from the team, but no one else seems to really be hitting, like, from a like actual content point of view, the same way Henri is doing. Like, there's not necessarily that alignment there. It felt like Buhadi especially, like, basically it said, like, I'm going to bounce from this team, right?
Back yeah, in the day. Right. Yeah, that's right. A few months ago, Buhadi said she was taking a pause from the national team and initially was fairly vague about the reasons, but since right. then has been more clear in tying it specifically to Diakra.
Yeah. Okay. So Where are we at now? Because Henri does come back to the national team, at least for a bit.
Yeah, so after Henri, you know, goes on Canal Football Club, Legret, again, the president of the Federation, made some comments publicly that he expects Diakra to select the best players, that her job is safe, but she has to put the best players on the field. So that kind of reads as a message, you know, you don't get to cut her now. So Diakra selects Henri for this past camp that's just finishing up, but it's been horrible for her during this period. She's been ignored at times by the coach. They had a blow up in the weight room that ended with Henri asking if Diakra was threatening her, and she's almost certainly played her last minutes as captain of the French national team, and I think she's considering whether it's worth sticking it out, whether it's worth, you know, maybe doing the same as Buhadi and just walking away.
Right. Okay. So I think a lot of the initial reaction is just like, why wouldn't France's Federation step in a more meaningful way beyond just kind of like that vague public comment of like, well, I guess I expect her to pick the best players. Like, where, you know, I think from a U.S. point of view, we have seen kind of that internal conflict with a coach that did not quite bubble up to this level here, right, with Jill Ellis, got handled internally. Even, and again, like the same thing happened where you get the affirmation of the coach in power saying like, nope, you guys have to deal with it. Like, this is the coaching hire we've made. So where's the Federation's, like, does the Federation care enough? Is that it? Is that what's happening?
The Federation, or at least Noah Legret, has gone all in on Diakra. I think one of the frustrations has been the way the Federation's messaging has kind of changed, where it's been, you know, we'll handle it internally, we'll have a meeting, we'll resolve tensions. And then as soon as the team qualified for the Euro, then Legret says, you know, I think it's all over and done with. The team seems fine. You know, I'm not getting into ancient history right, as though it's not 3 weeks ago. Yeah. I think the reason that the Federation has really refused to act is that I don't think it wants to be seen as caving to pressure from Lyon. And there's at least a camp of Diakra supporters who think that this is a Lyon versus Diakra problem and not a true Diakra problem. But but the players and many of the French journalists say that that's not the case, that it is a broader issue, and that it's just that other teams like PSG have barred their players from commenting on Diakra because they don't want all of the chaos that sort of come with Henri and these guys speaking up.
Right. Okay. So maybe to take a little bit of a step back, you know, I remember reading a huge piece in the New York Times about the culture of the France Federation that comes into play. I think that there are internal politics, as you're just talking about with PSG, Lyon, the Federation, in terms of who holds power in women's soccer. Could you maybe walk us through some of, you know, it's not just Henri versus the coach, right? There is kind of this larger landscape of women's football in France that seems to be kind of an ongoing saga amongst itself. You know, I mean, like, even going back to the 2019 World Cup, I think, you know, there were expectations with the country hosting the World Cup, right, that things had maybe gotten sorted out. There were expectations of, you know, that they would perform at a certain level. I think a lot of us looked at Diakra not picking Katoto for that roster and going like, that seems like a decision that you could make, sure. But have always been some of these moments where you look at them and you're like, what exactly is happening over there? And I don't want to make you like personally responsible for whatever France is doing when it comes to women's football, but is there some context that you think is important for people to know here?
Yeah, I think there's no way to see women's football as anything more than an afterthought for the French Federation. The priority is always going to be on men and the men's leagues, and they want to be seen as, you know, interested and involved in women's football, but they're also sort of happy, I think, to ride on Lyon's success and PSG's success as well, to say, you know, clearly we're doing fine, those teams are doing well, so, you know, pay no attention to the fact that the league here still isn't fully professional, or that the stadium conditions for some of the teams are really very poor. And they also, too, I think, have said that the World Cup was a huge success in terms of getting girls to enroll more in soccer teams, but haven't really kind of grappled with trying to move the French national team to the top level. And so you see a lot of what Legret has said about Diakra as well. She hasn't lost a game since the World Cup, so the results are good. Why would we get rid of the coach? But you look at those results, and it's mostly European qualifiers against Serbia, Kazakhstan, North Macedonia. And when they've actually played competition that they'll face in the Euros, like the Netherlands or Austria, there are some draws in there. And there's no real big, like, marquee wins against a Germany and England, something that you'd consider real competition. So,
right. You know,
of course, they're beating these sort of lower tier teams. So,
Is there pressure? You know, like I feel like here again in the U.S., if the U.S., you know, I mean, I think about them going to France at the start of 2019 and losing to France, and right. the immediate reaction of just like, well, we're doomed, right? Like there is that kind of close watch of the results from a media point of view, at least within like our little sphere, right? Like maybe not everyone, but there is like a public watching and going like, well, that doesn't line up with what we expect out of this team. And art, like, I feel like obviously France fans of the national team must have those expectations because like, I think we have looked at France for so long saying like, they have the players that should break them into, you know, like not just a top five team, but like really competing for a run at a World Cup. And this was supposed to be the one. And obviously like you get that USA versus France quarterfinal, but you know, expectations have been there. At least I feel like on this side of Atlantic, is there anyone putting pressure on France to live up to those expectations?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there is that level of expectation from the public, from the media. The challenge is sort of who bears the brunt when the team falls short. And so some of the folks defending Diacre don't want to hear what the Lyon players have to say when they're saying, well, we can't win with this coach, because they're saying, well, we haven't won anything with you in the national team yet either. Is that fair? Probably not. But at the same time, when nobody has managed to take the national team to the next level, there's sort of becoming a bit of frustration globally. But you do look at these players that are aging out, and as Henri said, you know, the time to win with this generation is now. Not, you can't make a change 3 years from now. You need to do it now before the Euros, the Olympics in France, the next World Cup.
Right. All right. Do you see, well, we can go back to the actual conflict here. I mean, it seemed like you have a vague sense of like Henri, at least certainly weighing the possibility of just being like, I'm good. Like I tried, like I said my piece, I'm going to feel comfortable if I walk away knowing that I did what I did. But do you think that there is a path for both, you know, like, if it really seems like Diacre isn't going anywhere and Henri is going to stand her ground, is there any other outcome beyond her walking away and this team just moving along under this coach without her?
I think the federation elections in March are going to be essentially high noon for the women's national team. If Legret is reelected, he continues to back Diacre, nothing changes. I think at that point, you know, Henri doesn't want to be treated the way she has in this camp. And I think you heard similar things from Bouati, that she didn't like the interrogation she had to undergo, that she went 10 days without the coach speaking to her in one camp. And so players like Henri are just going to say, there's no point to that. And, you know, maybe Renard as well, maybe Catateau as well. These other players that have that conflict. So if Legret stays in, Diacre stays in, I think then you potentially look at a wave of player exits. If Legret loses his spot, someone new comes into the head of the federation, he probably doesn't lose election based on the women's national team issue, but like you said, the New York Times pointed out the federation's got bigger issues. Someone else comes in, maybe there's a new voice to listen to, you know, these star players saying, this isn't working and this atmosphere isn't going to allow us to win.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is really interesting just to have, I mean, I remember, again, the New York Times posting that like big glass door story about U.S. soccer in the middle of the World Cup, about U.S. soccer and the culture there. And then now to see like France essentially going through the exact same thing. It is just such a weird reflection where it's essentially the same problem, but you have just such a weird different spin and culture on both sides. Like, but fundamentally we have culture problems, and I feel like they're not the only two federations to have culture problems, right? Like this is the challenge of soccer federations and how they approach women's soccer. And I mean, we see it at every single level of the game in terms of like questionable actors entering the space and leaving it worse when they leave. But is there, where, I mean, and this is again, like super big picture for you, but in terms of where we have seen France in the past, where we could, you know, there are a couple of different paths for France to go. It seems like now almost, I wonder if you have to just start looking and going, how do they fix this ahead of 2023? Instead of, or I mean, I guess they really, Euros, right? Feels like it's going to be the priority.
That's the one. Yeah. It's got to be the Euros.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's right. That right now they sort of have an opportunity to get set for that Euros. You know, they can benefit from not having to go to the Olympics. And so they could use this time to look at the areas, the roster that they need to develop and to build that kind of unity and to go in and you know, try to do what they weren't able to do in 2019 or even 2017. But there's a feeling that they're losing time because they, when the best case scenario feels like a change after March, you know, you start to run into trouble. But you know, there's something really positive about players, I think, speaking up and commenting on the federations that, you know, we've sort of moved beyond the era where having a women's national team survive and function and be operational was the first concern. And now you kind of have players taking more ownership and saying, it's not enough just for us to exist. We need to be in the right conditions to, you know, succeed and win.
Right. If Henri ends up walking away from this team, what do you think that does for the actual composition of the France national team? Because that is also the team's captain. Like, I mean, there are a few names when I think of the France women's national team. Henri is absolutely, at least in that top, it might be Wendy, right? Like Wendy, I think, is kind of the default for a lot of us. But Henri's right there next to her.
Yeah, I think you lose really two important things. You have Henri's leadership and she's brought so much to this team. She's not necessarily the most vocal leader, or at least hasn't been until now. But in terms of her play on the field, you know, I think back to the World Cup game against Brazil when she scores the extra time game winner and you know, team piles on the substitute salute along the touchline. So you have that leadership piece of it. But then the other challenge is that the midfield, I think, is really the place where the depth in the French national team is lacking. You have a lot of great attacking options up front. You know, even when you're missing some folks, you could live without a Eugenie Le Sommaire. You've got some interesting up-and-coming defenders, too. No one's Wendy Renard, but you can conceive of moving forward without Wendy Renard. But the French midfield is a challenge. It was a challenge in the last World Cup, and it becomes more of a challenge as you lose players like Henri. And the pipeline doesn't match the other position groups. So, you know, you really need Henri to anchor that midfield in addition to all the intangibles that she brings.
Yeah. Also, I mean, as someone who appreciates holding midfielders, like, I feel like they're wildly underrated in terms of what they do, but also, I mean, having seen her in the US, right? Like that's the other joy of Henri is that we have seen her play with Portland. Like we know, like I have watched her play in person, up close and personal. And I'm like, oh yeah, this is why she is regarded.
Right. She's really good.
Yeah. Like she's legitimately really good. So it is like, I don't know. Also, the other one thing that I did want to ask you now that I've mentioned Portland is, do you think that maybe there's anything to her time in the US kind of like influencing her of how she's approached this conflict, and not necessarily like, she spent a lot of time talking to US national team players or anything, but I feel like, you know, that's kind of the interesting thing about the NWSL is it gives players an environment to like talk to each other about women's soccer and like the growth of the game and things like that. Like she's on a team with Megan Klingenberg, who's involved with the PA, but like Christine Sinclair, right, who is long been underserved by her federation in terms of big games and basically their entire setup as well. Like, do you think maybe that this has played a role just in terms of like how she approaches her role now as a leader off the field?
Yeah, I think it's possible. I think she talked a lot about how she found in the NWSL, the players' kind of personality shown through a little more than they did in France, that they did sort of more, I guess, like brand building and were more vocal. So I think, you know, that kind of you know, being able to put yourself to the forefront, I think may have been affected by her time in the US. And I think too, like you said, being able to exchange with players from so many different federations and get an understanding of what the expectations are and what the environment is like. I think too, having someone like Etta Hegerberg in the Lyon locker room may also have played a role as well, because of course, you know, Etta was famously willing to step away from her national team because of her issues with the federation.
Yeah, I guess Lyon locker room as well. I mean, you've got Marzahn in Germany, you've got Japan, right? Like there are a lot of, but Hegerberg really, you know, if we want to talk about different approaches to working with a federation, Hegerberg is definitely, I think, at the very far end. Like as much as the US get a lot of credit for, okay, we're gonna take some steps, Hegerberg is just out here being like, nope, goodbye, see ya. Like I'm out until you actually give women's soccer the respect that I think it deserves.
Yeah, and she was willing to take that step on her own and didn't need to have the whole team behind her necessarily, which, you know, takes a lot of strength. I think too, you know, kind of comparing the Henri and Hegerberg situations, you also get a sense of how in many ways it's impossible to win. Hegerberg took a lot of criticism for not making her problems with the federation sufficiently public, and at least the view of some commentators.
Right.
Whereas Henri goes on TV and you get a whole group of people saying, well, you know, can't you keep this in the locker room? Why isn't this private? So, you know, which is it? I think people are always going to have an issue.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, and we see that here too, of like, well, you agreed to a CBA. Like, I mean, there's always going to be people with opinions. And I think at the end of the day, like the question is, are the players comfortable with the actions that they have taken? And I don't know if you watched the Hegerberg doc that's on ESPN Plus yet, but like, yeah, it is. I mean, it's really fascinating just in terms of not just getting a better sense of what she was making a stand against, but also like her reaction to that criticism, I think is really fascinating as well. And then the frustration when the coverage just tends to focus on that over and over again, despite the fact that she is playing games with another team and, you know, doing the usual thing. So, I think it's going to be, so let's say Henri steps away from the national team. You don't think that is going to change anything in terms of Lyon, right?
No, I wouldn't think so.
Yeah. All right. Well, let me end with one more. What should we be keeping an eye out for beyond? Okay. So now we know March with the election for the France Federation. What else should we be keeping an eye out for in between now and then, beyond probably any future dust ups between Diacre and Henri?
Yeah. I think, you know, the next thing to keep an eye on is what Diacre's next roster looks like in the new year. And the extent to which she keeps bringing in the sort of troublemaking Lyon players, or the extent to which she, you know, continues to kind of drop them. That's, I think every time there's a French roster announcement, everyone sort of holds their breath to see what new nonsense is coming. But you're right, the federation elections, that's the one to watch.
All right, perfect. Please tell folks where they can find you, find your work, so that way, again, I think that you are really a go-to resource for this, the France updates that we all need, but want to make sure that people know how to find you.
Yeah, absolutely. You can catch me on Twitter at @ascavs. I also write for Lyon Offside, a blog about Lyon men and women's team, and those are the best spots. I'm always happy to chat about France or Lyon or the Division One title race. Plenty going on.
How are you feeling about the Division One title race with that PSG result?
I mean, that's hard as a Lyon fan. Like, watching a loss is really a very unusual experience. It really takes something out of you. But But it'll be interesting to see how the back half of the season plays out, because, you know, PSG has a tendency to fall off a little bit against some of the other teams in the table, and Hegerberg coming back, I think Leon's going to have a lot to say before the season's out.
All right. That's a perfect place to end it. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for explaining all things France. I personally very much appreciate it.
Yeah, sounds good.
All right. Thank you to both Brooks and Ariana for their time this week. Two conversations I have been really excited to have since I basically asked them in the middle of last weekend if they could please come on this podcast despite the holiday weekend. All right. One more thing, as always, just honestly, thank you to everyone tagging me in your Spotify Wrapped post this year. I did not really ever think this through, but it is so cool to see how much everyone is listening to the show and to see other folks like Equalizer Soccer or Julie Foudy's Laughter Permitted or Katie Nolan or Kelly O'Hara's pod for Just Women Sports in the mix for everyone too. So keep those tags coming. I love them all. It's so cool. And also on that same note, tell your friends, subscribe, rate, and review. You know the drill. Full Time with Meg Linehan is on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, The Athletic, wherever you listen to your podcasts. Your ratings and reviews on Apple help so much, and as I tell you every single week, I read them all. Thank you for taking the extra step to support the show. And again, I've got one more thing. Go New England Revolution. Now, if you enjoy this podcast and do not yet subscribe to The Athletic but would enjoy more women's soccer coverage and more sports coverage, or you would like to read all of those stories that I told you were on The Athletic, the link to do so is theathletic.com/fulltime. A reminder, if you are listening to the show this week on December 3rd or 4th, you've still got a little time to take advantage of that $1 a month subscription deal, so please get on it now. You can find me on Twitter at It's Meg Linehan. Our podcast producer is Michael Zimmerman from The Athletic. I'm Meg Linehan. Thank you for listening.